A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Vyvanse is a prodrug. You can't snort it. You can't inject it. The abuse potential is dramatically lower than immediate release stimulants, and yet it sits in the same regulatory bucket as straight dextroamphetamine. That's not pharmacology. That's bureaucratic inertia.
That's exactly the entry point. The listener, Daniel's friend, the one who wrote in, has been on Vyvanse for a couple of years, and the medication works. The problem isn't the drug. The problem is that the system around it assumes he'll never lose a pill, never travel, never have a missile land on his refill date. Korn, read the whole thing.
Here's what he wrote. I have ADHD, and I've been taking Vyvanse successfully for the past couple of years. We've touched in previous episodes on the bureaucracy surrounding stimulant medications, but I'd like to revisit the topic because it's become one of the most stressful aspects of managing the condition. Here in Israel, the system seems to operate with almost no margin for error. Depending on the pharmacy, I'm allowed to refill my prescription every 28 or 30 days, and even that doesn't seem to be applied consistently. In practice, it means there's almost no buffer if anything goes wrong.
28 versus 30. That two-day difference is already a design flaw, and we haven't even gotten to the emergencies yet.
The problem is that life does go wrong. During the first Israel-Iran war, my renewal date happened to fall on a day when the country was effectively shut down under a state of emergency. I genuinely tried to obtain my medication, but there was simply no way. Running out of Vyvanse and going cold turkey while missiles are falling isn't a situation anyone should have to experience, yet that's exactly what happened.
Going cold turkey off a stimulant during an active missile crisis. Your executive function is already under siege from the stress, and now you're withdrawing from the medication that helps you regulate it. That's not a fringe case. That's what the system produces when it builds zero slack into the process.
He goes on. Travel creates a similar kind of anxiety. Every year we travel to the United States to visit my in-laws, and before every trip I'm left hoping that an advance authorization request will be approved in time. If it isn't, I know I won't be able to fill my prescription before I leave. That uncertainty feels unnecessary for patients who are simply trying to maintain continuity of treatment.
And that's the phrase, continuity of treatment. He's not asking for extra. He's asking not to have his treatment interrupted by a calendar.
The underlying issue is that, for most of the past year, I've effectively had no safety margin. Losing even a single capsule meant I might not have enough medication to get me through until the next refill. That might sound improbable, but accidental loss really does happen. During our apartment move, I misplaced medication. On another occasion, I kept a small backup supply in the car and lost track of it. Once, in a moment of complete absent-mindedness, I dissolved a dose in water and then instinctively poured it down the sink before realizing what I'd done.
The sink one. That's the detail that got me. He dissolved it, muscle memory took over, poured it out, and that's it. That's his margin gone. For a month.
None of these were attempts to misuse the medication. They were simply the kinds of mistakes that people, and especially people with ADHD, sometimes make. He wants 2 or 3 weeks of backup. Then he asks 4 questions. Why do healthcare systems assume patients never lose medication, travel, encounter emergencies, or make mistakes? How do different countries balance diversion prevention with continuity of care? Is medical tourism for ADHD treatment actually feasible? Maintaining a relationship with a physician in another country and filling prescriptions there as a backup? And the nightmare scenario. You're about to board a flight to the US and discover you don't have enough medication. What are your realistic options?
That last question is the one that probably keeps him up at night. And we're going to give it a real answer, not a shrug.
So this is a system with zero margin for error. But before we get into what to do about it, let's step back and ask why it's built this way in the first place.
And the answer starts with a 3-letter agency in Washington. The DEA classifies stimulant medications, including Vyvanse, as Schedule II controlled substances. That's the second most restrictive category. Schedule 1 is heroin, LSD, drugs with no accepted medical use. Schedule 2 is drugs with accepted medical use but high abuse potential, morphine, oxycodone, methamphetamine, and, in the same bucket, listexamfetamine.
Listexamfetamine being Vyvanse, the prodrug that has to pass through your digestive system and cleave off a lysine molecule before it becomes active. You literally can't shortcut it, and it's Schedule 2.
Right, and Schedule 2 comes with a specific set of rules. No refills, period. Every single prescription must be a new written prescription. You can't phone it in, you can't fax it in most states. You can't get an early fill except under very narrow exceptions, and I lost a capsule, or I'm traveling, isn't one of them. The DEA's model assumes that every prescription is a potential diversion vector, and the way to close that vector is to make every fill a discrete, physician-authorized event.
So the U.S. builds a system where the doctor has to reauthorize every 30 days. Israel takes that template and adds its own layers.
Israel's Ministry of Health oversees controlled substances through its own regulatory framework, and here's where the 28 versus 30-day inconsistency comes from. Different pharmacy chains interpret the rules differently. Some count from the date the prescription was written. Some count from the date it was filled. Some apply a strict 30-day interval. Some allow a fill at 28 days, which effectively builds in a 2-day buffer over the course of a year. But there's no national standard that's enforced uniformly. So you walk into one pharmacy, and they say come back in 28 days. You walk into another, and they say 30. And the patient has no way to know which interpretation they're going to get until they're standing at the counter.
Which means the system isn't just rigid, it's unpredictably rigid.
And that unpredictability is itself a harm. If you knew it was always 30 days, you could plan around it. If you knew it was always 28, you could slowly build a buffer. But when it flips, depending on which pharmacist is working that day, planning becomes impossible.
Let's talk about what the system is actually optimizing for. It's not patient outcomes.
It's diversion prevention. The entire regulatory architecture is built on the assumption that the primary threat is medication leaking into non-prescribed use. And to be fair, stimulant diversion is a real problem. College campuses, recreational use, people selling their prescriptions. But the way the system addresses that problem is by treating every patient as a potential diverter until proven otherwise. The default posture is suspicion.
And the cost of that suspicion is borne entirely by legitimate patients.
That's the externalization. The regulator prevents one case of diversion, maybe, and 10,000 patients spend their lives doing calendar math and panicking about travel. The regulator never sees those costs. The patient who goes cold turkey during a missile attack doesn't file a report that reaches the Ministry of Health's policy office. The cost is invisible to the system that creates it.
The CDC has a whole guide for travelers carrying controlled substances. It's in the Yellow Book. Their travel health reference. They tell you to keep medications in original packaging, carry a doctor's note, check the destination country's laws. Solid advice.
And it assumes the one thing our listener doesn't have, the medication. The CDC's guidance is written for someone who already possesses a full bottle of pills and just needs to get through customs. It doesn't address the person whose refill date falls 2 days after their flight, or whose advance authorization hasn't come through, or who lost a week's supply during a move. The entire travel health infrastructure assumes possession.
That's the gap. The advice exists for what to do with the medication you have. There's almost nothing official about what to do when you don't have it.
Let me contrast this with how other controlled substances are handled. Schedule 3 and IV drugs, things like benzodiazepines, certain sleep medications, allow refills. A physician can write a prescription for a 6-month supply with refills. The abuse potential of some Schedule 3 drugs isn't radically different from some Schedule 2 drugs. The distinction is partly pharmacological and partly historical and political. But the practical effect is that a patient on a Schedule 3 medication has dramatically more flexibility than a patient on Vyvanse, even if both are stable, compliant, and have been on the same dose for years.
So we've established that the system is designed to assume patients never fail. Now let's talk about what that means in practice when you're standing at an airport with 3 days of medication left.
The travel question breaks into two pieces. One, can you bring your medication across borders? And two, can you obtain more medication at your destination? The first piece is manageable. The second is where it gets hard.
Start with the manageable part.
CHADA, children and adults with attention. Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, the major advocacy organization, has detailed guidance on international travel with ADHD medications. The core advice: carry your medication in original packaging with the pharmacy label intact. Bring a letter from your prescribing physician that states your diagnosis, your medication, your dosage, and that it's prescribed for a legitimate medical condition. Have a copy of the prescription itself. This documentation serves two purposes. It helps at customs if you're questioned, and it establishes a paper trail if you need to seek care at your destination.
But that documentation doesn't get you a refill.
It doesn't. And some countries make even possession difficult. Japan is the starkest example. Japan bans certain stimulant medications outright, including some that are standard ADHD treatments in the US and Israel. If you're traveling to Japan with Vyvanse, you need to apply for an import permit in advance through the Narcotics Control Department. If you show up without one, the medication can be confiscated, and in theory, you could face legal consequences. SHAD's guidance emphasizes checking the embassy website of your destination country before you travel, because the rules change and the consequences of getting it wrong can be serious.
So even the bring what you have step isn't frictionless. Now what about getting more when you arrive?
This is where the medical tourism idea comes in, and I want to address it directly because the listener's friend suggested it. The idea is, maintain a relationship with a physician in the US, visit periodically, and fill prescriptions there as a backup. It sounds clever. In practice, for Schedule II drugs, it's nearly impossible.
Walk me through why.
First, a US physician can't legally prescribe a Schedule II medication to someone who isn't their established patient. Federal law requires a bona fide physician-patient relationship, which typically means an in-person examination. You can't just email a doctor in New York and say, I have ADHD, I take Vyvanse, please write me a prescription. That's not a gray area, it's explicitly prohibited.
What about telemedicine? That expanded during COVID.
It did, and this matters. During the pandemic, the DEA issued temporary flexibilities that allowed physicians to prescribe controlled substances via telemedicine without an initial in-person visit. Those flexibilities were partially rolled back. As of now, the rules are in flux, but the general requirement is trending back toward an in-person visit before a Schedule II prescription can be issued. A visiting Israeli citizen can't simply schedule a telehealth appointment and walk away with a Vyvanse prescription.
So the medical tourism model assumes a level of flexibility that Schedule II regulations explicitly prohibit.
And even if you could get a U.S. prescription, filling it creates another problem. U.S. pharmacies won't fill a foreign prescription for a controlled substance. If a doctor in Tel Aviv writes you a prescription for Vyvanse, you can't take it to a CVS in Chicago. The prescription must be issued by a DEA-registered U.S. physician. And the reverse is true. A U.S. prescription isn't valid at an Israeli pharmacy. These systems don't talk to each other.
Which brings us to the nightmare scenario. You're at Ben Gurion. Your flight leaves in 4 hours. You've got 5 days of medication and a 3-week trip ahead of you. What do you actually do?
Let me be honest about how limited the options are. Option 1. Establish care with a U.S. physician at your destination. This requires finding a doctor who's accepting new patients, scheduling an appointment, which may take days or weeks, bringing your medical records, your diagnosis documentation, your Israeli prescription history, and ideally, a letter from your home physician explaining your treatment. The U.S. doctor evaluates you, determines that the prescription is appropriate, and writes a new U.S. prescription. This works. It's legal. It's also slow and expensive if you're paying out of pocket.
And it assumes you can function well enough without medication to navigate all of that.
That's the cruel irony. The condition the medication treats is the condition that makes navigating the medication access system so difficult. Executive function, planning, follow-through, those are exactly what ADHD impairs, and they're exactly what the bureaucracy demands.
Option 2?
Urgent care. Here's the reality. Most urgent care centers in the U.S. won't prescribe Schedule II stimulants. Their policies typically exclude controlled substances, especially Schedule II, because urgent care isn't designed for ongoing medication management, and the liability and regulatory scrutiny are high. Walking into an urgent care and expecting a Vyvanse prescription isn't a plan, it's a hope.
Option 3.
Your home physician coordinates with someone abroad. This is theoretically possible, but practically difficult. Your Israeli doctor could contact a U.S. colleague, explain the situation, and ask them to see you. But the U.S. physician still needs to establish you as a patient, still needs to do their own evaluation, and still needs to comply with DEA regulations. The coordination might speed up the appointment, but it doesn't bypass the legal requirements.
So the realistic answer to the nightmare scenario is, you can eventually get medication, but not quickly, and not without documentation, and not without paying for an out-of-pocket medical visit. There's no emergency pathway that says this patient has a valid foreign prescription and needs a bridge supply.
Correct. The system has no bridge supply mechanism. None. A patient with a documented stable treatment history who runs out of medication while traveling has exactly the same access pathway as someone walking in off the street asking for stimulants for the first time. The system can't distinguish between those two cases, and it's not designed to try.
That's the structural failure. The system treats continuity of care and drug seeking as the same thing.
And it does so by design. The regulator's calculus is, if we make the system flexible enough to accommodate legitimate emergencies, we also make it flexible enough for abuse. So we make it inflexible for everyone. The legitimate patient's crisis is acceptable collateral damage.
Let's talk about what patients can actually do, because I don't want to leave this as just a catalog of despair.
There are concrete steps, and they fall into two categories, documentation and buffering.
Start with documentation.
Before any international trip, assemble what I'd call a travel dossier. A letter from your prescribing physician on letterhead in English if you're traveling to an English-speaking country. It should state your diagnosis, your medication name and dosage, that it's prescribed for a legitimate medical condition, and the physician's contact information. Include a copy of the original prescription. Carry your medication in the original pharmacy packaging with the label intact. That label is proof that the medication was dispensed to you legally. This dossier won't get you a refill, but it prevents customs from confiscating your medication. And if you need to establish care at your destination, it gives the new physician everything they need to verify your treatment history quickly.
And the second category, buffering.
This is the practical art of building a small safety margin within the rules. If your pharmacy allows a fill at 28 days on a 30-day prescription, and you fill consistently at 28 days, you accumulate roughly 2 extra days of medication per month. Over 6 months, that's about 12 days of buffer. That's not nothing. It's not the 2 or 3 weeks the listener wants, but it's a start.
The catch being that filling early is exactly the behavior the system flags as suspicious.
That's the catch-22. The patient who fills every 28 days to build a travel buffer looks, on paper, identical to the patient who fills early because they're diverting or misusing. The pharmacy system doesn't know the difference. Some pharmacists will flag it, some won't. The inconsistency we talked about earlier cuts both ways. It creates uncertainty, but it also means that in practice, many patients do successfully build small buffers by working within the gray areas of the system.
So the buffer strategy works, but it requires navigating a system that might penalize you for doing exactly what you need to do to be a responsible patient.
And that's where the physician relationship becomes critical. If your doctor knows you're building a travel buffer and documents it, writes a note in your file, communicates it to the pharmacy if needed, you're protected. The buffer becomes part of your treatment plan rather than a deviation from it. The listener should have an explicit conversation with his prescribing physician in Israel. I travel annually to the U.S. I've experienced gaps in coverage. Can we document a plan that allows me to build a small emergency reserve? Some physicians will work with you on this. Some won't. But having the conversation creates a paper trail that protects you if the pharmacy questions an early fill.
What about the U.S. specifically? If he's traveling there, are there state-level differences that matter?
Yes, and this is underappreciated. Prescribing regulations for controlled substances are primarily federal. The DEA sets the framework, but states layer on their own rules. Some states have more flexible provisions for out-of-state physicians or for bridge prescriptions. Some states allow pharmacists to exercise more discretion on early fills. The practical advice is, before you travel, research the specific state you're visiting. Contact a physician's office in that area. Explain that you're a visiting international patient with a documented ADHD diagnosis and ask if they can see you if an emergency arises. Some practices will say no. Some will say yes, especially if you have your documentation ready. Establishing that contact before you travel turns a cold search into a warm lead.
That's a concrete step. It doesn't solve the systemic problem, but it gives you a lifeline.
One more thing on the US side. If you do need to see a physician, be prepared to pay out of pocket. An uninsured visit with a psychiatrist or a primary care physician who manages ADHD can run anywhere from $200 to $500, depending on the region and the practice. The medication itself, if you're paying cash, can be expensive. Vyvanse doesn't have a generic in the US yet, and brand name pricing can be steep. None of this is ideal. But knowing the costs in advance means you're not surprised at the pharmacy counter.
Let's address a misconception that I think a lot of people hold. The idea that you can just go to any doctor in the US and get a refill if you run out.
That misconception is dangerous because it leads people to not prepare. Schedule II drugs require an established patient relationship and, in most cases, an in-person visit. Urgent care centers generally won't prescribe them. Emergency rooms might give you a day or two if you're in acute withdrawal, but they're not going to write a 30-day Vyvanse prescription for a visitor. The system simply doesn't have a mechanism for this person has a valid prescription from another country and needs a bridge supply.
The medical tourism idea, maintaining a physician in another country as a backup, that's not a real thing for Schedule II drugs.
It's not. I understand why the friend suggested it. It sounds like a clever hack. But the legal barriers are structural. A U.S. physician can't prescribe to a non-patient. A foreign prescription can't be filled at a U.S. pharmacy. The only way to make it work would be to establish genuine care with a U.S. physician, meaning you see them regularly, they know your history, you're their patient, and then fill prescriptions when you're in the country. That's not medical tourism. That's just having a doctor in two countries, which is expensive and logistically complex and probably not what the friend was imagining.
I want to go back to something the listener said that I think gets at the deeper problem. He dissolved a dose in water and poured it down the sink. That's not carelessness. That's a person with ADHD doing something that people with ADHD do. The medication treats the condition, but the condition makes it harder to manage the medication.
That's the recursive trap. ADHD impairs the executive functions you need to navigate a complex medication access system. You need to track refill dates, plan around travel, maintain documentation, advocate for yourself with physicians and pharmacists, all tasks that require precisely the cognitive skills that ADHD undermines. The system demands flawless executive function from people whose condition is defined by executive dysfunction.
The system doesn't just fail to accommodate that, it actively punishes it. Lose a capsule? That's your problem. Forget to request an advance authorization in time? Your trip is now unmedicated. The system treats every mistake as a personal failure rather than a predictable outcome of the condition it's supposedly treating.
There's a concept in engineering called failure tolerance. A bridge is designed to handle more weight than it'll ever bear. A server cluster is designed so that if one machine goes down, the others take over. Good systems assume that components will fail and build in redundancy. The ADHD medication system has zero failure tolerance. It assumes that patients will never lose medication, never travel unexpectedly, never encounter a pharmacy closure, never make a mistake. That's not an oversight. That's a design philosophy that prioritizes enforcement over care.
The cost of that philosophy is borne by the people who can least afford it.
Let me give you one more piece of practical advice that I haven't seen in the official guidance. If you're traveling to the US and you're worried about running out, contact CHED. They have a resource directory and can sometimes help connect you with ADHD specialists in the area you're visiting. It's not a guarantee, but it's a starting point that's better than searching blindly.
Given all these barriers, you might think the situation is hopeless. But let's walk through the concrete steps someone in this position can actually take.
Step 1. Build the travel dossier. Diagnosis letter from your prescribing physician in English. Copy of your prescription. Original packaging with pharmacy labels. Do this well before you travel, not the night before your flight.
Step 2. Research your destination state's specific rules. Contact a physician's office in advance. Explain that you're a visiting international patient with documented ADHD and ask if they can accommodate an urgent appointment if needed. Get a name. Get a phone number. That warm lead is worth its weight in Vyvanse.
Step 3. Have the buffer conversation with your home physician. Be explicit. I travel annually. I've experienced gaps. Can we document a plan that allows me to fill slightly early and build a small emergency reserve? Get it in your file. If the pharmacy questions an early fill, your physician can confirm it's part of your treatment plan.
Step 4. Understand the maximum legal advance fill in your system. If your pharmacy allows 28 days, use that consistently. Over time, you accumulate a buffer. It's slow, but it's the only realistic way to create a safety margin within the rules.
Step 5. If the nightmare scenario actually happens, you're in the U.S. without enough medication, know that your path is to establish care with a U.S. physician. It'll take time. It'll cost money. You'll need your documentation. But it's possible. It's not a dead end. It's just a slow, expensive detour through a system that wasn't designed for you.
Those strategies can help you survive the current system, but the bigger question is whether the system itself should change.
That's where I want to leave this. The listener's experience isn't a personal failing. It's a predictable outcome of a regulatory architecture that treats diversion prevention and patient care as a zero-sum trade-off. They're not. A system can prevent diversion and accommodate legitimate emergencies. It just requires regulators to care about both goals, not just one.
The burden of building safety margin shouldn't fall on individual patients doing calendar math and hoping their pharmacist is in a good mood. But until the system changes, that's where we are.
If the system is this broken and the workarounds are this fragile, why hasn't patient advocacy pushed through reforms already? Is it just that ADHD patients are too disorganized to organize?
That's a sharper question than it sounds, Hilbert. Part of it's that ADHD itself makes collective action harder. Organizing a movement requires exactly the executive function skills the condition impairs. But the bigger factor is that the harm is dispersed. 10,000 patients each lose a few days of medication a year. That's a crisis distributed across 10,000 private experiences, not a single visible disaster. Regulators respond to concentrated harm. A plane crashes, you ground the fleet. 10,000 people quietly run out of medication while traveling, and nobody files a report.
The other piece is that stimulant policy is driven by the abuse narrative, and that narrative has powerful institutional backing. Patient voices are competing with decades of drug war framing. It's an asymmetric fight.
Thanks, Hilbert. That's the right question to end on.
If you've navigated cross-border ADHD medication challenges or found a workaround we didn't cover, write in. The show's email is show@myweirdprompts.com. Your experience could help someone else staring at a calendar and doing the same math.
This has been My Weird Props. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.